Today, my conversation is with Neil Cocker. Neil is based in Cardiff, Wales, and so I think that's the first time I've had somebody from Wales on the podcast, and this has been a lot of fun. He's basically kind of a startup founder himself. He is a community builder. He is a mentor and really trying to develop kind of a startup culture in Cardiff, Wales, as well as being a big proponent of AI tools and prototyping. And so this conversation is super fun. It talks everything about customer discovery, some of the pitfalls that he sees in kind of entrepreneurs and how, you know, discipline, talking about people that have a propensity to code versus actually doing some custom discovery, the role of tools like Replit and Bolt. And so it's a fun conversation. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. Neil, welcome to the podcast. I appreciate you making the time.
Hey, thank you, Todd. It's great to be here. I'm really, really excited to be talking. I think you're South Dakota, right? So
I am.
It's Wales to South Dakota, which is not a connection that's often made.
No, I agree. I think you're the first person on the podcast from Wales. So congratulations. Yeah. Happy to have you.
Yeah, great.
So that's good. So why don't you start with a little bit about your background and kind of what you're doing today, and then maybe a little bit about how you got there.
Sure. So my background's kind of weird, actually. I spent the first 10 to 15 years of my career post sort of graduation from college, I spent in the music industry. So I was ran a record label. I was a DJ producer. I toured all over the world, some like 20, 30 different countries. And so when I think a lot of my current peers were sort of cutting their teeth in tech, I was kind of stumbling out of clubs in Tokyo and Sydney and
3 o'clock in the morning.
Yeah, San Francisco and stuff like that. You know, so I was very, very lucky, and I kind of that was a great part of my life and my career, but it's very much a lifestyle. It was one of those things of like, it sounds very impressive, but actually it wasn't a huge amount of money in it. It was like a lot of touring. The record label we had a sort of UK top 10 hit. But again, you know, we were too sort of naive to really capitalize on that and make a lot of money. You know, just a bunch of guys running a lifestyle business in their 20s, just enjoying life. But then off the back of that, I saw an opportunity around print-on-demand merch. So, you know, the big players, people like Cafe Press, Redbubble, that kind of thing. But nobody was really doing a good job of that for the music industry. So in other words, they just weren't serving bands, DJs, record labels, live venues very, very well. It was all very, like, it's fine, like, if you had pictures of unicorns or your softball league or whatever that you wanted to like sell or you know, but actually if you wanted to build a presence for your band or your record label or your, you know. And the insight really came for me as at the time as a touring DJ and producer, there's a real culture of merch for bands, right? You go and play your gig and then you stand at the back of the gig with your merch table and you sell t-shirts, right? And that's a revenue stream, because very often you weren't making money from the gig itself. You're getting paid like $50, $100, $200, but actually you could earn just as much money from selling t-shirts back, right? DJs didn't have that facility, right? Because there's just no culture of a DJ coming to the back of the club and then starting to hawk their kind of t-shirts. So it was kind of an online thing, and frankly, I didn't know what I was doing. Like, I had no background in tech. I had no idea about scaling. I had no idea about technology. I basically went and made every mistake under the sun. I went and employed a developer, I'm sure this is a topic we'll come back to again and again, but like, I just went and built, and I say I paid somebody else to build without the faintest clue of what the true problem was I was really solving. I thought I knew, and there's a kind of a problem space I kind of roughly understood, but fundamentally I didn't really understand. To the point that me and my co-founder were printing the t-shirts ourselves, right? So we thought the product was t-shirts, right? We'd rock up to investment meetings and go, hey, feel the quality of our t-shirts. And we'd be amazed that like the investors were like, honestly, I don't care. Like, that's not your product.
That's not the product. It's the platform.
It's how you basically supplement the income of independent musicians and DJs and whatever, right? So it took an embarrassingly long time to get to that realization. And a lot of that is because I'm in a small ecosystem, a relatively immature ecosystem, right? Cardiff is the capital of Wales, but it's relatively small city. I think it's bigger than where you are, but like, it's not that much bigger, right? It's not London. It's not Berlin. It's not Paris, right? And so there are any very few people here, certainly back then, sort of like 10, 15 years ago, who really knew what they were talking about. Nobody who's going to put their arm around you in a pub or at a meetup or a cafe and go, guys, you are doing this all wrong, right? Yeah. We were just getting advice from people who'd built very generic, old-fashioned businesses, right? So fast forward a few years, we kind of make all the mistakes under the sun, and I spent a lot of time then realizing that I was very often the smartest guy in the room, and that scared me because I knew how unsmart I was. So, I ended up kind of building a community here around in Cardiff and building a tech startup community that still kind of operates today. And then fast forward a few more years, we eventually exited the business. But because we had built the culture of the startup and the processes and the thinking embedded in the team on what I will call poor philosophies, poor methodologies, whatever, it never scaled to the potential it should have done. Mm-hmm. So, you know, the exit was fine. Like, everyone got some money and, you know, life became a lot easier. But the reality is I was still frustrated that didn't really do what it should have done, right? And so most of my work today is almost as a byproduct of my frustration at having never been challenged. Nobody ever sat me down and asked me hard questions. And I think that is still pervasive in startup support today, right? You know, I know the ecosystem is slightly different in the States, but in the UK, there's a lot of very generic, publicly funded, government-funded business support programs, right? Or the public-private partnership or whatever. There are very few. It's obviously in places like London or whatever, your Y Combinator equivalents and very, you know. But fundamentally, your first port of call when you're looking for business support or startup support in the UK, it's going to be someone who is funded by either a brand or government. And the reality is they just don't know, for the most part. They've never done it. And I'm not someone who's a purist about this. I believe that some, you know, you can get good advice from people who haven't done it, but it's the exception to the rule, right? You know, there are some good people I know who've never really laid awake at 3 a.m. going, holy shit, how am I going to make payroll? I've got 2 months and the investors aren't picking up the phone, whatever, right? Yeah. But for the most part, I want to take that advice from people who've been there, right? And unfortunately, the very nature of Wales and Cardiff is there is a very small percentage of people who've been there, right? Was actually as a per capita, if we go to Silicon Valley, if we go to London, if we go to Paris, the percentage, not just the scale, not just the amount of people, because those are big places, but the percentage of people and the density and the likelihood of in that network meeting someone who can give you deep, relevant challenge and advice is much, much higher. So yeah, so that's where I am right now. Like, most of the work I do is shouting at startup founders that nobody cares about their product, their beautiful baby that they've spent like a long time building. And I kind of feel like a lot of the time it's breaking hearts, right? It's like, look, I know you've been working on this for 2 years.
Yeah.
The market doesn't care. So we have to find a way to make the market care or to understand what the market really does want. Like, and that's it really. It's like, understand the very true nature of the problem and go from there rather than product first mindset.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I guess, you know, even it, we'll get to this as the conversation goes on, but with the advent of AI and the technology, I think you have to get to, you know, do I have a business faster, right? And so, you know, we have basically a 6-month program where you really do customer discovery and you do a lot of validation. And we spend way more time on customer discovery than most people want, because I think a lot of businesses are built because they produce a product that nobody really wants, right? And maybe they like a feature or something, and maybe it's marginally better than what they have, but it's not something that's going to change people's behavior. And they're not going to change and go from this product to that product and pay you. And I think that's what we really try to emphasize. But, you know, we'll talk a little bit about like AI tools really crashing this. this. And, you know, we look at it and say, you know, $10,000, $12,000, you can figure out with 6 months whether you have a business or not. And I think that's all we're really looking for. If you have a business, then let's figure out how to invest in that and scale. But if you don't, let's not spend 2 years on something that's not going to move you in the right direction. And so I think that's kind of what we're
This is something I'm really interested in, right? Is cadence, right? Yeah. And like, you can, all you're doing in these early stages of validation is looking for signals, right? Yeah. Is it worth me putting more time and money into this thing, right? Until we reach such point that there's product market fit or something approaching that, all you're doing is like, whether it's a landing page or whether it's an MVP or whatever, it's just something in the market to elicit a signal from your potential customers. Like literally earlier today, and I'll be sensitive about how I talk about this because there's a very high chance he'll listen to this, but like I was speaking to a founder, right, who in fairness, his first thing was like, we did everything wrong. We've had a lot of bad luck on the way, but we did everything wrong, right? And he acknowledges that, right? But like they spent probably in dollars, probably $2 million. They are 5 years down the line. And they have nothing in the market and no customers, right? Wow. Now, that's a very extreme example. And in fairness to him, he's like, we know we've done everything wrong, right? And part of the reason he's talking to me is like, okay, can we use some of these AI tools to now get something out in the market tomorrow, right? But the problem is they have a legacy product. And this is nothing I didn't say to him earlier. So if he's listening, then I'm not kind of betraying any confidence. But like the problem is that, like I was saying about my startup, my first startup, is there's a big sunk cost fallacy that is in danger of dragging them down. And so my job is, you know, potentially is to go in and say, look, honestly, I don't care what you've built. I don't care, because also the nature of the market has moved in the last 5 years as well. Yeah. The nature of the customer has moved. You know, I won't say too much more than that because I don't want to betray that confidence. But like the reality is everything's changed in the last 5 years, right? So your understanding of what the customer pain was 5 years ago is no longer as relevant as, you know, perhaps you might hope it is. So the difficult thing is then working with founders to unpick all of that, those biases, and say, honestly, it doesn't matter. Like, if we're going to start from scratch, we have to just go, you know what? That $2 million is gone. Yeah. And maybe there's some parts of the work that you've done, whether that's research,
salvageable.
You know, the relationships, maybe the conversations, great. But you have to almost let go of the tech and just say, look, because actually, your newsletter yesterday spoke about this like perfectly. Yeah. It's like just building in, you know, without any understanding of the customer problem. And I know they have some to our conversation before we started recording that they do have domain expertise, which is great. You know, they do have some of that, which is minimizing that risk somewhat, you know, because again, this stage, this zero to one stage is all about signals and it's all about reducing risk, right? So that when you do go to market, you're not 5 years down the road and $2 million deep, right? You are, you've done it in like a month, 2 months, 10K, whatever.
Yep. So I guess one of the things that maybe I'd sharpen a little bit on this, or just the question, I think that a lot of times founders come to us and they want to build the Taj Mahal. They have a vision in their head of all the things they want to go do. And I think what we kind of say is, what are the handful of use cases that we can put into an MVP that basically gets them to change the behavior and pay for something? You don't graduate from our program without having a shipping product and paying customers, full stop. It doesn't matter. And I think, again, it's super hard to look at this list of things that say, I want it to do all of these things, and have the discipline to say, what are the three or four items or use cases that are actually going to move the needle and make somebody pay for it? And I don't know if that like happens with you, but like every single person that we talk to, I think they get into Figma, they want to design the hell out of this thing. And you know, you look at it and you're like, that's a $60,000 application that's going to take you 6 to 9 months. And what we really need is something that's going to be done in 2 months, and we can test whether this actually resonates with the party that you have, the persona and the beachhead. And if it does, great, we keep moving forward and add the new. If not, then we basically have to scrap this.
Yeah, and I think it's a learned behavior, I think, right? Because I consider myself one of the people, you know, as a percentage of the planet, I probably understand this more than, you know, the overwhelming majority of people, right? I understand the importance of doing this customer development stuff before you start building. But I think there is a correlation between the type of person that is drawn to entrepreneurship and also the type of person who likes to build and get their hands dirty. Sure. And so what, it's a discipline, right, of like constantly dragging yourself back. Like, I've been building some bits and pieces with Lovable and Replit and Bolt and stuff. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, oh man, I've done no customer development because it's just nice. Yep, sometimes, right? And I understand this stuff better than almost anybody, you know, you too, right? Yep. And yet the reality is there's something innate, I think, about perhaps the behavior or the nature of an entrepreneur is that they want to build, right? In some way, shape or form, right? And so there's a real discipline. And I found that, like, I was a consultant director of a fintech accelerator a couple of years ago. And so I was working day in, day out with a bunch of startups for a year. And what's really interesting is very often they would come into the program and, like you say, they've got the Taj Mahal in their head, right? Mm-hmm. And you'll sit down for your first talk with them and they'll tell you everything about their business, about what they're going to build. And then I'll say, what's the problem you're solving? And they can't answer that, right? Or they can't answer that quickly and easily, right? Because they don't have a full understanding of it. So then you have the hard conversation with them of like, nobody cares about your product. They care about the problem you're solving for them, right? Yeah, your product solution is just a process, a method of getting to that point.
Yep.
And then eventually you'll see the light go on, right? And it's two things. It's like, it's almost happens in the space of a second. The realization hits of like, oh, I've been thinking about this all wrong by going product first when actually it should be problem first.
Right.
And then the terror hits of like, oh, everything we've been doing for the last 18 months is dead, right?
Throw it away.
Or potentially. Yep. Not always, but like potentially, right? The difficult bit is then they go, I get it. I get it. It's opened my eyes. I get it. And you see the lights go on and they've like really committed. And then you'll see them again in your next weekly or fortnightly review. And you're like, what have you been doing for the last fortnight? And they're like, oh, we've just been building this thing. Yeah. And you're like, oh, man. And it's like, it's a learned behavior. And you have to keep dragging people back, right? And including myself, right? It's, you know, even no matter who you are, whether it's going to the gym or getting up and going for a run and whatever, it's like, this is a discipline to keep yourself problem focused, not product focused, when actually every fiber of your being just wants to start building bullshit, right?
Yeah. So we have kind of a methodology around this that I'm kind of just curious on your feedback. I think it creates some structure to it. So we do all these customer discovery calls and meetings, and we're pretty detailed. And then you basically extract out what you think the MVP use cases are. Then you basically go to Figma and you start designing some of what the UI is going to look like. Then you go back to all the people that you interviewed and you said, if this was a beta, would you sign up for it? And if you don't get more than 50% of those people to say yes on a free beta, you have to go back to the zero. Like, you do not go forward. And what it forces is, like, if they're not willing to sign up for it, that it's just not going to happen. There's not enough value in what you're creating. And so once we get this flywheel going to the point where, okay, I've got 60 or 70% of the people that I interviewed, then I go build it. Then you go back to the beta, you run the beta, 70% of them actually did it, or 60%. What we're finding is more than half of them will actually pay. Now you got your first couple of customers. Then you can build kind of what is the demographic of this individual? What's the beachhead? How do I build more lists to get to these people, whether it's a B2B or B2C? And so it creates some discipline in this. But to your point, it is painful and people do not like it. They like it once they get to the build process, but like, they chafe at the discipline you need to do this right. And our opinion is 45% of companies fail because they don't do this process well.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah. I mean, you've obviously got those metrics there, but I mean, my gut feeling is it's more than that, right? It's like, you know, the majority. And I think what's interesting there is you're like saying, okay, so you take a Figma to them. I think there's two things, right? So, you take Figma to them, and then as long as you get 60, 70% theoretical sign up, then it's worth going and building something.
Spending dollars to go build.
Right. But like, my you've obviously seen through your metrics that you can map that to a 50% real dollar conversion, right? Which is great. My instinct is like, how do you, in a real, in an ideal world, you want to bring that payment commitment forward even further, right? Can you get them to sign on the dotted line from the Figma, right? And then you Wizard of Oz it, you kind of like, you fake it somehow. Like, you
we've know, had but, some but, that have done that, Neil. And so I do think that's something that, like, if you can build a compelling enough solution and the pain is high enough, there's no question you can do that. I think when the pain isn't as high, then I think you have more problems with it. And so I think you can do a reduced version saying, hey, this is half price. If you buy now, people will be doing it. But I think if the pain in the market and there's really nothing there to solve it, they will do that. They 100% will do that. I think when you have, you're doing a competing product and you're trying to displace somebody, it's much harder to do. And so I think there's context to the startup and the space you're in and the pain that you're trying to actually resolve.
Yeah, absolutely. I think, trying to get that, well, I suppose the other thing I wanted to say was, like, you have those, you're starting to develop those metrics now, and I've increasingly become a believer that there are missing metrics around behavior here, right? So I talk about this as a discipline, right? And there's a ton of, like, data out there from Crunchbase, LinkedIn, social media, whatever. Like, you know, these VC firms are taking all this data, but what exists in a black hole that most people don't see is behavior, right? Now, let me give you a really simplistic example of that, right? If I give you two identical founders solving the same problem, same products, same background, same skill set, whatever, and one of them has spent 3 months building a product that is beautiful, looks good, works well, seamless, and comes to you with that product, and another one comes to you and says, look, I've only got this kind of crappy product because actually I've just spent most of this 3 months speaking to customers. Which one are you putting your money on, right?
I give them a hug. The second one, I give a virtual hug right away.
Right. 100%, right? And yet, the reality is when you go and pitch your investment or you stand on stage, it's very easy to be drawn to the shiny, or that those ones might have an easier time, you know, selling or whatever, right? But the point is there is a hidden behavior there, and that hidden behavior is speaking to customers. And you will not see on Crunchbase or LinkedIn or social media, we spoke to 200 customers using a good customer development methodology. So I have a thesis that there are some hidden predictive behaviors. The problem is measuring those, right? Because most accelerators, startup studios, whatever, you know, no, I went down a rabbit hole of this a few years ago and started to think about building something. But, like, what? No startup founder is going to fill out a form at the end of each day going, and this is what I've done today, right? They've got too much, other, you know, it's like, you know, they might do it for a couple of weeks, or they may even do it if you force them while they're part of a program. You say, you don't get the money unless you fill it in every day, right? But
sure. But
fundamentally, that goes as until the day they have to stop doing it and they stop doing it, right? So there's a real question to be asked is, like, what are the behaviors that map to future success? But also, how do you measure those behaviors when they do not exist in a visible context?
So I think you're hitting on something that's kind of near and dear to our heart. So I think there's some fundamental flaws in the way in the VC private equity raising capital. I think, you know, a lot of times the confident PowerPoint well-designed deck wins, right? And I think that's just inherently wrong, right? And so we look at, you know, programs that we compete against. We, you know, like Generator and Techstars and some of these, they give $100,000. We've had people that have gone through those programs, crashed and burned, and come back to us. And basically they're saying, I got the money, I spent it on dev before I even knew I had a customer, right? Like, and so it's the same problem we're talking about. But really what they did was they put a ton of money and time into getting a great presentation and a good PowerPoint to raise capital. And I think this is all wrong, right? I think what we're trying to say is, how do you get to a sustainable business as quickly as possible that generates revenue? And if you want to raise capital, that's fine, but do it from a point of, I know my customer, I have my product, and I have paying customers. Mm-hmm. What I find is VCs and folks they generally, if they can see that and they can find it, they'll invest in that versus the person that has a nice PowerPoint. And this needs some massive unwinding. I think some of the other things that are kind of interesting, you know, our program is something like 76% women and minorities. And wow. We didn't design it that way. We didn't come and say, this is what we're trying to go do. But, you know, women are probably 10% in startups. And so I think what we've done that's a little bit different is we need a relationship. We have a lot of people that come to us and say, I want access to your money, I want access to your devs, and I want access to your investor network. And we said, well, we want to sharpen your product differentiation before you get in. We want to understand kind of what your beachhead's going to be and what your persona looks like. And they just bail out because you're trying to give them some constructive feedback. And they're saying, no, I have it all figured out. I just need your resources. And those are the people that jettison out of our program. It's the people that are saying, okay, you're asking me some hard questions that I don't know the answer to. Can you give me a little bit of understanding what I need to go do? You do it. And then they come back and they iterate and they iterate and they iterate. And we're like, hey, those are the people we want in our program.
So they're coachable, right? And I talk about coachability a lot, right? Yes. It's like, you know, yep. And I have to caveat this all the time. It's like saying, being coachable doesn't mean you just blindly listen to what I say.
That's
it means
correct.
You at least you consider it and go, okay, you might be wrong or you might be right, but I will consider it and I will go away and, you know, whatever. So, and yeah, there might be something like, I don't know, you know, around that kind of, I think men and a particular type of guy is more likely to buy into that very kind of bro, startup bro, tech, smash it, build it 24 hours a day, you know, build whatever
your
idea.
Very confident. I've got all the answers.
Right. Yep. And I think there is something to be said for that. Like, but you're right. Like when I ran this accelerator program for a while, like we struggled to find not women or not good women, because the women who applied were incredible. Like, and I would agree with your hypothesis or your thesis that like generally they tend to be better, but just as a number, like just getting them to apply was difficult. You know, thankfully almost everyone who did apply who was a woman ended up being on the program because they were great. Right. Right?
Yeah.
Certainly
yeah.
A lot higher percentage than the men. So yeah, I think, and I wondered like you, I wanted to come back to that thing you were saying about Figma and that process you have of like, almost like gating, like I think there's something to be said for like you only get to unlock the next part of support, whether that is financial, mentoring, whatever that happens to be, when you have reached a gate and you've proven that you can open that gate, right? And I think, you know, whether most startup programs tend to be, well, you know, you're on the program and now you get everything, right? And I think
there's
a couple of things there. One is like, I think I'm increasingly very, very strongly of the opinion that we should be supporting the founder, not the startup idea, right? So particularly if you're government funded or there's public money in there, one of the metrics is like, is this business still alive in 3 years' time, right?
Yep. Yep.
Which is a dumb metric because there's nothing worse than a zombie startup. Like everyone right. loses, you know, the investor, the founder's paying themselves 14K, you right. know, or whatever that is, right? The national economy is losing because honestly, they should have gone and got another job.
Job or, and added to the value. Yeah.
Or started something better.
Mm-hmm.
But I wonder now, like we talked briefly about the AI thing, like what does that look like when actually you can almost circumvent the Figma stage with Lovable or Replit, right? And I don't believe that like Lovable can yet design something that a really good front-end designer can design, but it can do enough, right, to put something in somebody's hand. And so, you know, something I've been encouraging some startups I've been working with recently, it's like, it's about a sales conversation. You don't have to give them something that is perfect. You know, this is, remember, minimum viable product.
Right.
Whereas I try to get people to think about minimum viable test. Because I think when they hear minimum viable product, they think product, something that I can sell. And actually, it should be like, it's a test. Put it in their hands. Will they use it, right? And they, I think there's going to be a really interesting thing now of like that cadence. Like actually, if we can get something functional, we don't have to go even through Figma, and you know that's a shortcut, right? Doing the what you're talking about, the Figma bit is a shortcut, but there's an even better shortcut. The only issue I see with that is, while I think there's a huge democratization that stuff like Lovable and Replit allow, because non-technical founders like me can suddenly get stuff in the market or at least get prototypes built, it also means that there is going to be an exponential amount of AI slop, startup
garbage.
Slop
app,
right? it's just going to be a tsunami, right? And, I think, how do we get that validation, critical systems thinking, to come back to yesterday's newsletter again, right? Like, how do we get that into not just the startups that you and I interact with, because you and I only interact with a
small percentage,
tiny percentage, even of those in our ecosystem, right? It's how do you build that across an entire that thinking, because it still seems utterly prevalent. You would have thought, you know, we're 20 years deep into startup world, right? Whatever that is, since the dot-com boom, and still the overwhelming majority of startups do the wrong stuff foundationally.
So I agree with you, and I think even just looking at our own program and figuring out how to scale, right? I think we've been pretty body intensive, but I think one of the things you talk about a lot of these tools from a prototyping standpoint, I think some people are missing the boat where this infrastructure, you know, whether it's N8N or LangChain or some of these other tools, basically building more of this infrastructure in. So we have agents that basically are on our front end sales. We have agents for the customer discovery, and essentially it's not crazy, right? It's basically a checklist of all the things you have to do in what order, right? Yep. And there's lots of prompts to help you do that. And this goes to your mentor. This goes to every 2 weeks you have to do a mastermind where you're accountable for everybody else, and there's transparency to it. So if you did that all the way through, and so we only have really three sections. We have the customer discovery, then we have a build process, and then we have go-to-market. And we have some post-go-to-market, which is really about scale. But, you know, if you could almost open source all of that, does that give you an operating system to have some discipline that anybody could go through this, right? Where it's like saying, I got a checklist and I basically can go follow through this and basically understand what the steps in the process are. And it's not rocket science, Neil. You know it. It's hard work. And I think going back to the article that I wrote about no black boxes, I think this is where most people get trapped, right? You said it before. Somebody that's interested in building product gravitates to building product. They don't want to do the sales piece of it. They don't want to do the front-end discovery process. And so what we're trying to do is get entrepreneurs educated enough to do something in each one of these areas so that they at least understand the ecosystem. They understand how to troubleshoot the problem when they have an issue. It doesn't mean you have to do sales forever. But like in the article, this was based on somebody that I knew. They were a technical founder, and they did the first 100 demos. And they said, man, it sucked. But they knew exactly what to hire for, and they knew what the product roadmap needed to look like. And so, and when the salesperson was having a problem, they knew how to help troubleshoot and understand how the messaging needed to change. And so I do think those two things, one of them is a methodology that is self-disciplined and like you can go through it on your own. And then the second part is we have to educate people that it's okay to figure out what marketing looks like. It's okay to understand how to develop and do some Figma or to Lovable or to figure out what a demand funnel really looks like and how to build a persona. Like we have to give them the tools that make this a little bit easier to do so that they get over the fear of failure.
So here's my question then, but, and this is a rhetorical question, everyone's had access to Rob Fitzpatrick's mom test and Paul Graham's blog and, you know, and YC startup school stuff for a decade. Like what's stopping everyone doing that anyway, right? So that's the bit I'm really, really interested in, is like, you and I know best practice, we can apply best practice, but what's stopping the overwhelming majority of startups, and also VCs, right? Like VCs have no real better, despite all their acumen and expertise and education, they don't really have any better success rate than probably your casual angel, right? Yeah. So there's something there, and I'd love to unlock that. I think programs are definitely going to have to change in the age of AI, just because the speed of iteration is different, right? So maybe we have to move away from something that is as linear as you and I typically would have built, right? It's like, okay, you've simplified it nicely into those three really key bits, like customer development, build, and go to market, which is pretty much, you know, I can't see any fault with that. It's pretty much the perfect way you should do that, right? But like, you say a 2-week stand up, a 2-week check in. Are we now going to have to move to like a 2-day? Because like, actually, in two weeks,
it's moving fast.
Four or five prototypes, or you know, there's. And again, I don't have the answers, and I'm not expecting you to have the answers. I'm just really fascinated by like what we're gonna, and also funding, like funding changes, right? If I got, you know, typically in the UK, outside of London, your early pre-seed fund would look like £250,000. So, you know, $300,000, $350,000. But most of that was on dev, right?
Yep. Where it's not anymore.
Right. So, and that's not to minimize the fact that, you know, some of my friends who are sort of professional developers are like, well, you know, you can't build anything that's production with Lovable. And it's like, yeah, I broadly agree that it's not wise to just go and launch to the public. But remember, in this phase, we are not, we're trying to prove product market fit. We're not trying to the end product here. Like, we're trying to prove that people will buy this thing. So, yeah, I'm just really interested in like how we, I'm fascinated why this learning hasn't just been taken to heart.
People haven't just talk about that for a second, because I have some opinions, right? Like, I mean, you can look at like, you know, classes from Stanford, from MIT, from Harvard. They're all online, right? And so how many people do you know that actually go do that, right? And so, and how many people would say, I don't know about it, but I haven't used it? Like, there's tons of people that know about it and they just don't do it. And so my opinion is there's a discipline and an execution that's missing, right? And so there's never been a better time if you're intellectually curious and you have discipline to educate yourself. And so I do think that's a big part of it. And so even like with us, we do not want, you talked about like people that are coachable. The second piece that we look for is, we give you some feedback, but how well do you execute on it? And we want to see 2 or 3 revs on that, right? Before we ask you to join the company. Because again, coachability is certainly one thing, but it's like, if you can't execute, like you don't belong in the startup world. Like you have to learn how to execute well. And you see lots of people that have the right answer, but they can't get it delivered. And so I do think we're subdividing maybe characteristics that we think are good foundational elements for founders to get to success. And so I think maybe the answer to your question too is like, I think there is a lot of information on, I mean, I have a whole library of books in front of me and they're all the ones that, you know, you talk about, you know, good to great and you talk about 0 to 1 and you, Peter Thiel, all these things, but like the majority of the founders are not going to sift through all that. And so I think we have to simplify it into a methodology that gives them some step-by-step, and not everybody's going to do it. But I do think the ones that want that and feel like there's value in it will kind of get through it.
So, yeah, so I think that it's, again, it comes back to my sort of thesis around you have to support the founder and not the startup, right? So if you support the startup, you're just blindly saying, well, we agree that this is a good idea, right? And actually what you should be saying is like, we bet on you, and it doesn't matter if it's going to take you 2, 3, 4 attempts, we'll find a way to get through there. Like, so there's the discipline to understand the importance of customer development. And the example I always use, and I've been using it for years now, is like, if you ask 100 people, have you ever spilled a drink on your desk? 100 people say, yeah, I have, right? And your entrepreneur monkey brain goes, well, great. Well, 100% of people have
this problem. That's a problem I can solve.
Yeah, right. But if you ask them a different question, is like, what did you do last time you spilled a drink on your desk? Almost everyone says, well, I got a cloth and I wiped it up. Were you thinking about it 5 minutes later? No, I wasn't.
No.
Okay, so total different reframe understanding of the problem. The other bit is about the human nature bit. So I'm always brought back to you almost certainly won't know who I'm talking about. He's the captain of the Welsh rugby team. Now, rugby is the national sport of Wales, right? It's a huge thing. And you probably know enough about rugby to know that these guys are big guys. They are strong. Yeah. They are powerful. They're the equivalent of your football players.
Without the pads. Know, they,
yeah, it's right. But it's insane. But and so the captain of the or the former captain of the Welsh rugby team is a guy called Sam Warburton, right? And he is like Marvel movie perfect human being, right? He is a triangular upper torso. He's also the nicest guy in the world. And because Cardiff is a small place, he's like the kind of guy I would see walking around town, right? Mm. But anyway, so he says he very regularly, I was listening to him on a podcast a while back, he says very regularly has people come up to speak to him and say, oh, Sam, I'm trying to lose weight. I'm trying to build muscle. I'm trying to get strong. I'm trying to get fit. And he's like, what have you tried? And they'll go, oh, well, I tried this diet and I was going to the gym and blah, blah, blah. And he said, in almost every single instance, I will say to them, how long did you try that for? How long did you apply that discipline? And they'll be like, ah, a month, 6 weeks, you know, 8 weeks. And he's like, well, what the hell did you expect? Yeah, right? This is a lifetime discipline, right?
Commitment.
And Sam Warburton's been retired several years, right? He's still like, you know, probably only in his 30s, late 30s, but it's an incredibly punishing sport that doesn't reward, you know. But he still looks incredible, right? You know, you see him on TV or like commentating on games and stuff. He's still exactly the same, right? He's still just pure muscle, like lean, whatever.
Yeah.
It's a discipline. And I think identifying those founders who are willing to do the hard yards, they're willing to get in the gym or, you know, whatever the equivalent is, and then embody those behaviors all the way through to product market fit is really tricky. It's human nature. Like, almost all of us know that actually the right thing to do tomorrow morning is get up and go for a run, go to the gym, whatever. But actually a tiny, tiny percentage of us will do that, right?
Yep.
And as supporters and investors and whatever, our job is to identify them, lift them up, and support them where we can, rather than getting too bogged down in like supporting the product, the idea, right? Which is what I see here in Wales all the time. It's like, because most of the projects here, the programs are funded by public money, they have these dumb KPIs, these dumb metrics, right? Which is like, is the business still alive in 5 years' time? Is the, you know, so, and it's just like, and none of this rewards somebody sitting down with a founder and going, prove to me that there is a customer need here. Prove to me that this problem exists and that people would change their behavior in order to use your product. And that's fundamentally the missing bit, I think, from almost the overwhelming majority. And like you say, like, you know, you've identified some big names there, and you're saying like that you're seeing that startups come out of that, and they're, you know, I've had exactly the same thing. People come to my accelerator programs and stuff off the back of being in quite big London accelerator programs.
Yeah.
And they said, I asked more challenging questions in the
questions.
First. Maybe I'm a challenging person. Maybe that's what said something about me, but
Don't you think though, like I always think about like founders, I guess the good ones, and even for myself, I think that like, you got to like enjoy the grind versus the outcome. So it's the process versus the outcome. And I think the people, because there's always going to be problems, there's always going to be challenges. And if you're looking for the sale, or you're looking for, I got it to $10 million, you know, like those goals are great, but you got to like revel in the grind. And I do think that like what you've just described is process out over outcome, right? And so if you're good, if you want to go to the gym all the time and you don't, and you make that a habit, your outcome will come. If you do the hard work in your startup, the outcome will come. Like it's just everywhere in life. And I have two kids, and it's like, that's probably one of the bigger things that we've really impressed on them is do the hard work, the outcome will come. You know, do your studying, you'll get good grades. Work hard in your sports, you'll end up doing fine on the pitch. And so, I think it's the same thing with startups.
Yeah. And the thing, I was speaking to a guy who ran like a Series A accelerator a few years ago. So these are, you know, startups that now had 20, 30 headcount, they'd raised $1 million+, you know, they were kind of getting there, right? But pre-product market fit. And he said that still the number one problem he had then was getting them to speak to their customers, because they thought they'd validated because they'd raised all the money, they had the team, whatever, right? And so at the moment I'm spending a lot of time working with companies, not always startups, but like bigger organizations, teaching them how, you know, building with Lovable, building with Replit, building with Bolt, and even NAN, or, you know, just agentic stuff, basically helps their sales process. Because instead of waiting for your dev team to go and build the thing to sell it, you can put something in their hands the next day, right? So I spend a lot of time in those, working with companies on that. But what's really, really interesting, and it's some thinking that a lot of them have never been exposed to before, because they're not true startups as you and I would perhaps identify them, is I spend the first hour of every day with these companies going, this is why validation is important, right? Because a lot of these people are just like professional developers or professional like data scientists. Like, there's an oil and gas data company I was working with a couple of weeks ago, right? None of those people had ever run a startup. They were employees, right? They're very smart people, very technical people, but they'd never been. But I spent the first hour going, this is what validation is, and this is why it's important. Because otherwise, if you don't do this, you're going to waste a lot of your time, a lot of your employer's money, and likelihood is that your share options in 3 years' time aren't worth anything, right? So,
you know. Now you're talking.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. But you hit them in the wallet, right? That's what people care about.
Yeah.
So it's going to be really interesting to see what the next 18 months, 2 years means for obviously just startups. I think entrepreneurship has changed, right? Entrepreneurship fundamentally changed. Like it changed 20 years ago with the advent of the internet and, you know, Web 2 and whatever. But like we're just about to hit something that is, and I think most business support processes, most accelerators, you know, startup studios even, which is, you know, perhaps the logical progression of accelerators, right? They're the next stage of that. I think a lot of them just aren't prepared for it. Certainly the publicly funded ones aren't. They're very linear. They're very slow. The checkpoints are like monthly, you know, and you and I, you know, could in a month, what could we do in a month, right? We could burn through three or four business ideas, right? So, you know, all those human resources, all those financial resources, all the government, all those private resources that are just being wasted on building, frankly, crap that nobody is ever going to use or buy, right? So I think there's a big reckoning coming. I really do, and I don't know what it looks like.
It's interesting to me, though. I almost have maybe a more of an optimistic view. You know, I worked at a company called Concur, and then we got bought by SAP. And, you know, I do some consulting work with companies that we started with small that are now 10 million or growing. And it's interesting to see even like I just was at the $10 million one and, you know, like getting them to really think through AI and how it integrates into their systems to really scale. They have so much legacy, right? And they have tons and tons of wiki articles and data. And they're just struggling to like figure out how to take this infrastructure that they've been building for the last, you know, 8 years and then bolt on or insert, you know, different tools where, you know, like a lot of the startups, even like Wildfire, like us, we have nothing, right? And so we've started from an AI first standpoint. And so, you know, and as soon as there's a repeatable task that we end up doing, we have to get that on the platform to get it rid. And so, and then you're teaching the same thing for this next pair of entrepreneurs to start there. I really feel like there's an opportunity because, you know, like Salesforce, they're tied to this code base of CRM and like they can add, you know, agents and stuff like that. But if you design that product from scratch, you'd have a different design if it was AI first. And so I just think there's a huge opportunity for all of these, especially in the B2B space, that if people are really willing to lean in and kind of rethink the design around AI first and individuals, they're going to have, like these incumbents are going to have problems competing long term, in my opinion.
Yeah. I mean, not least because, I mean, I'm still a shareholder in another startup that I'm no longer part of on a day-to-day basis, but like, we use HubSpot there, right? And I think we pay like hundreds of dollars a month for that.
Easy.
Right?
it's expensive.
Yeah, right? And we probably use like 5% of its capabilities. Yeah. And I think, you know, with a bit of patience, I could probably spin up a CRM myself in a couple of days that does 99% of what that does, right? My own personal thesis around SaaS, like like everyone, I'm an entrepreneur at heart, right? I still want to build things. I still want to create things. But my own personal thesis around AI at the moment, or the stuff that I kind of want to build, is like solving problems with technology, but where there is an inherent community and personal element built in, because I think as these LLMs grow, as ChatGPT, I mean, you know, every time ChatGPT does an update, like 10,000 AI rapper type startups go out of business, right? It's just like, you know, and I think they've launched Study and Learn. I only found out about it today. I didn't even notice, but like there's an option under the, you know, you've got agent, you've got deep research, whatever, but there's Study and Learn.
It just came out,
right?
So yeah. Yep.
Right. So, and I was just playing with that today and it's like, oh, does that kill off 1,000 AI supported study bots?
Yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So I think I think a lot of smart startups now, there's going to be the B2B stuff, but certainly the B2C stuff, they've got to start thinking about how they build in community, humanity, personal connection. Because I'll tell you one thing, I'm broadly skeptical of people who make big predictions about where we're going technologically with, you know, particularly the pace and speed at which things are changing with AI. Like I generally, like, none of us know, right?
You know, yeah, right.
Most of us are guessing, right? Because none of us could have foreseen this 5 years ago, right?
Nope.
But my big bet is that within 5 years, maybe even within two, the equivalent of Lovable, Replit, Bolt, V0, whatever, will be bundled on every smartphone, right? And so, if I need a single use app or a personal app, like a to-do list or a calorie counter or a shopping app, a shopping list app or whatever, I spin it up. It's three prompts, whatever, right? Because, you know, I've been fairly deep in Lovable and Replit since very, very early on. And I say that as if it's been decades, right? It's been like, it's been, but like I've been, and I have seen immeasurable change in that time, right? So I wonder the capabilities in terms of back end and what they can do. And even just like stuff like security and edge functions, row level security that didn't exist like best part of a year ago are now like baked in. So I just wonder, that's my kind of outside bet, is that every phone, you know, Apple comes bundled with build your own app, right? I don't know what it does to their app store revenue, and I don't know whether that's a case that's thought through, or whether it's just like, you know what, I've got Replit on my phone anyway. Like Replit has an app and it's pretty decent. I just wonder now if like the whole personal app thing, mobile stuff, is kind of in danger of, you know, unless there's something that inherently links me to other people who've got the same app, it has less value.
Yeah, I think you're directionally right. I mean, I've always kind of started to stay away from some of the consumer stuff just because I think it's commoditized and it's hard to do. It's hard to get mass, you know, adoption of it. And the business models I don't love, right? I'm not interested in advertising. The subscription can be hard. I'm a B2B guy, and so that's, you know, that's where I think this domain expertise is the maybe buttress of the moat for some of this, right? Like if you understand all of the intricacies for civil engineering and wastewater management during construction, okay, well, that's a very unique set of skills, and it diverse in the United States, it's different by state. Okay, well, then that's a defensible position, and if you can build some logic around that, that's a valuable product.
I mean, they're dry businesses, but I'm always really, really excited about businesses that have sprung up around regulatory change.
Yep.
It doesn't sound sexy or exciting,
no,
right?
No, it doesn't. Value, right?
I mean, you would be perhaps less aware of it. I'm sure you've heard of it. We have in Europe a thing called GDPR, right? Is our data protection law, right? Yeah. And there were a lot of millionaires who got made off the back of GDPR in the UK. Like people who build, who allow you to embed cookies into your site with a single line of code, right? Yeah. Like, holy crap, like a lot of money was made there, right? So, and same, like Cardiff is, it's one of the areas, one of the very few areas where Cardiff genuinely punches above its weight, and that's fintech, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so as a result, there's a lot of heavily regulated businesses here. You know, there's one or two unicorns here, like who fintechs. And yeah, it's just like there's a huge, huge opportunity there. Like it's, but in general, it's going to be a really interesting time for B2B SaaS. I think that domain expertise, I think you're absolutely right. But the more commoditized stuff, CRMs, lead gen, I posted on LinkedIn yesterday. Like, I mean, I know lead gen is kind of one of those grubby little kind of those lead gen agencies are kind of just leveraging existing data sets. But agent now would send like 20 connection requests and DMs for me as a test yesterday on LinkedIn, you know, on ChatGPT LinkedIn, right? ChatGPT agent. So that's me not needing a lead gen agency. And I could have built it in NA10 anyway. It was just, but it's a lot easier because NA10 has a bit of a learning curve and whatever,
sure,
right?
But
yeah, there's some seismic shifts. And I just don't think most people are ready for it and aware of it. And I think another part of my thesis is like, let's dive in and start swimming really hard and just try and stay on top.
Exactly. Well, as we're kind of closing this out, like, are there maybe a handful of things from your experience, maybe in the last year or two, that you would really recommend for kind of early stage founders to play around with? You're doing a lot of prototyping. You're using a lot of the current tools. But like, you know, I think maybe crash some of your experience to like, what are some of the clear takeaways that you've learned over maybe the last 18 months?
Sure. Okay. So, I mean, you know, the obvious stuff that I think has been true forever is like speaking to your customer, but speaking to your customer correctly, right? I mean, we talked about the spilling your drink on your desk, right? It's all very well and good. And say, hey, I've spoken to my customer. They said they love it. It's like, that's not proof, right? I mean, you know, the classic text is Rob Fitzpatrick's mom test, which I recommend to most startups to go and read. It just teaches you how to have those conversations. And I suppose the other bit is that although there is going to be a tsunami of AI startup slop and whatever, and most of it will be killed off every time ChatGPT, Sam Altman opens his mouth, like any time anything changes, like 80% that's going to go, right? And most of it was never going to survive anyway. But like, what this means is, coming back to your point about B2B and domain expertise, that is even more important now, right? Because the only thing that separates you from the startup in the next office is your knowledge of your customer. Because all of a sudden, there's a huge democratization of technical skill, you know? And again, I'm not trying to minimize, like, you know, I can hear my developer friends screaming at me as like, you know, they still have value. And of course they do. I'm not saying for a second that like, you do not need, actually what it allows you to do is employ them to do the good stuff, the important stuff, the scalable, the real serious
stuff. Keep moving up the stack. Yep.
Yeah. Right. Like, so yeah, I don't want you to build another sign-in page. Like, just, let's just get that stuff done. 10 minutes, like, get it done, get the ugly stuff done. But what I think, like, embedding deep insights throughout your organization, from developers, customer acquisition, sales, founders, C-suite, whatever it is, like, I think that's one thing that I think I've made a mistake in before, is like, I think I haven't been good enough at communicating the end picture and the customer pain to employees before. And it took me a long time to learn that, right? I was just like, I was very much, I was too busy kind of communicating what we were doing and the importance of what we're doing, rather than saying, look, we're trying to go over here because this helps this person do this.
Sure.
And then everything flows from that, right? Yeah. So yeah, I think that's it really, is just like, you know, it's become ever more important. Just because you can build this stuff doesn't mean you should.
You should.
Right? It's ever, you know. If you build it, they won't come. I promise you.
Exactly. I think it's a good way to leave it, Neil. I think this has been super helpful. It, you know, it's cool to see some of the corollaries. You're running a different program that's similar, you know, trying to solve similar problems. And so it seems like we've got some really good kind of alignment in how we see entrepreneurship and how we can help them. And so I appreciate you spending the time and kind of sharing your wisdom and experience.
Hey, it was a real pleasure. Really great to meet you, Todd.
So if people wanted to learn more about you or like some of the programs that you're associated with, what's the best way to do that?
So probably the best thing to do is either go to neilcocker.com. Okay. That's Cocker as in the Spaniel, or productmarkethit.com.
Okay.
Which, so Product Market Hit, which, was one of those domain URLs that I was really surprised still existed. I only bought it about a year and a half ago. And I was like, nobody thought of Product Market Hit before. It's like, great.
That's pretty crazy. Yeah. Well, good for you. So good. Well, thank you very much, Neil. I appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to the Startup Stories from the Treehouse. If you enjoyed this episode, please take a moment to like, follow, or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And if you found our conversation helpful, leave a review. It really helps other founders discover our show. For more insight and episode summaries, don't forget to subscribe to the Wildfire Lab Substack. We appreciate your support and can't wait to share more stories with you next time.